This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrerotia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrerotia. Tune in as our guests speak up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Kia ora. Welcome to this episode of Speak Up Kōrerotia with Sally Carlton, your host. On the 14th of October 2023, Australians took part in a referendum known as the Voice to Parliament. The referendum proposed altering the Constitution to recognise the First Peoples of Australia by establishing an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice. The voice is sort of a group, and the group would then be able to make representations to Parliament on matters relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. The referendum did not pass, with 60% of people voting against it and all states in Australia voting against it. Conversely, however, Australia's Indigenous communities overwhelmingly voted in favour of the change. The outcome of the referendum was perhaps not unexpected given what the polling had said, but still nonetheless a really disappointing result for Indigenous peoples and Indigenous rights and white allies in Australia and elsewhere around the world. Also, the months preceding the referendum saw rigorous and sometimes quite heated debate among commentators, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous. In Australia, here in Aotearoa and further afield, on issues such as Indigenous self-determination and representation. In our show today, we reflect on the referendum and the arguments raised by the yes and the no camps, and especially think about the potential implications of the overwhelming no result. The format for today's show will be three one-on-one interviews, with each guest focusing on a different aspect of the referendum and its outcome. Firstly, we'll have Kate Hunter from Te Heringa Waka, the University of Wellington, who will introduce the referendum and situate it in a longitudinal context, as well as reflect on the potential implications of the no result in terms of Australia and Australia-New Zealand relations. Secondly, Amy Maguire of the University of Newcastle will talk us through some of the controversies surrounding the referendum before considering what the outcome might mean for Indigenous rights in Australia. Finally, we have Claire Charters from Te Kahui Tika Tangata, the Human Rights Commission, who will focus on the ways in which the situation of Indigenous peoples in Aotearoa, New Zealand was used by both sides in the referendum campaign, as well as the ways in which the outcome may impact Indigenous rights in Aotearoa and internationally. Okay, so you've heard that this show is going to be broken into the three different parts. Our first guest is Kate Hunter, who's going to be talking to us specifically around a bit of an introduction to the referendum and placing it in its context, which is going to be very important, I think, to understanding what's happened and why. Kate, if you could please tell us a little bit about yourself and sort of situate yourself in this discussion.
Thanks, Sally. I'm Kate Hunter. I am Professor of History at Victoria University of Wellington, Te Heringa Waka. I'm an Australian historian. I grew up and trained in Australia, and I was employed here as the Australian historian. So I've been teaching Australian history here at Te Heringa Waka for almost 30 years. I have a real interest in Indigenous politics and in the history of Indigenous life in Australia.
Kate, if you could start us off by maybe introducing the Voice of Parliament referendum, what is it and why has it come about? Could you talk to us about how this referendum has been sort of a accumulation of many decades or centuries worth of what's been going on in Australia?
Aboriginal people have, from day one, resisted European settlement and invasion of their lands. But where I would fit the referendum is within really the 20th century battles. In the 19th century, there were many appeals made to governments, to the Crown. There were petitions, there were delegations. But within the federal structure. So the Australian Constitution was written in 1900 for 1901. Aboriginal people were a problem, in inverted commas, in that drafting of the Constitution, because some Indigenous people had the vote in South Australia, some in Western Australia. The other group who were a problem in the eyes of constitution makers, of course, were women, who also in some colonies had the vote. So trying to figure out whether in the federal system you could enfranchise everybody who already had the vote, or whether that needed to not happen, was a substantial debate. So I think that 1901 constitutional debate, and especially about the vote, was one in which 19th century racial science played a huge part, and Aboriginal people were in the end excluded from the vote unless they were already on a roll. So it was a sunset clause that was put in place. So really from then, Aboriginal people campaigned for civil rights as well as land rights. And it was a period in which legislation was becoming more and more punitive. Aboriginal life was coming more and more under the control of the boards of Aborigines that were set up by governments. Their mobility, their employment, their marriage, and then, of course, probably best known, their child rearing. In the interwar period, Aboriginal groups began forming that were specifically political lobbying groups, I think we'd call them in the modern parlance. They were versions of what we'd call advancement leagues. Some of them were called the Aboriginal Advancement League. The Western Australian one was the Natives Union of Western Australia. And this came out of both Indigenous people's membership of trade unions, so seeing that union movement as a way of achieving things, but also from service in World War One, which had promoted a form of kind of soldier citizenship. And probably the most well-known protest was on the 26th of January 1938, which was the 150th anniversary of the arrival of the First Fleet. And there was a big protest in Sydney called the Day of Mourning, and there were petitions published in newspapers really calling for Aboriginal civil rights, for a recognition of Indigenous people suffering under white rule, and for lands to be returned. These groups were led by, you know, probably some of the best known names in 20th century Aboriginal political history. And then with World War II, a couple of things happened. One was that a lot of white Australians were exposed to Aboriginal people for the first time. They met them, they worked with them, especially when Australian Defence moved into the Northern Territory. Probably really significantly, Gough Whitlam was with the Air Force during World War II in the Northern Territory, and it was his first experience with Indigenous people. He got to know them. He spent time with them. But also, of course, World War II demonstrated to the world the logical outcome of racial policies. The revelation of Hitler's death camps really changed the views of a lot of governments on the ways they were handling their Indigenous people. And, of course, it accelerated a lot of decolonisation and independence movements around the world. So Aboriginal people had won the vote by 1962. And in 1967, there was a referendum to bring Aboriginal people's Aboriginal affairs, as it was called, under the Commonwealth government, because the states had been so uneven and often very poor in their handling of Aboriginal lives. And so with civil rights won in a formal sense, the shift then turned to land and the lobbying power of Aboriginal people and of their white allies turned much more to land rights, which is where we saw the land rights movements of the 60s, 70s and 80s becoming much more of a focus. So the push for constitutional recognition really sits within this long history of Aboriginal use of kind of the white fella system of governments, of constitutions, of referenda, of petitioning, of court cases, all of those structures that govern our legal and constitutional frameworks were used by a large number and a wide variety of Aboriginal activists across the century.
That was a fantastic summary. Thank you so much.
The immediate history of the referendum is that it's the culmination of what's been a 12-year project. It was introduced by Prime Minister Julia Gillard's government when they established an expert panel on constitutional recognition of Indigenous peoples in 2011. That started off a process of a great number of parliamentary committees, of public processes. I think there's 10 public reports done in that time. The voice as the form of the recognition evolved from a different process which ran alongside, which was among First Nations communities, again involved a huge number of meetings, a huge effort of consultation amongst hundreds and hundreds of Indigenous leaders across the country. And that culminated in 2017 with the Uluru Statement from the Heart, the closest thing Australia's had to a pan-Aboriginal statement, an invitation to non-Aboriginal Australians for dialogue and a call for action. And so it called specifically for constitutional change, and because it's a shift to the constitution, we needed a referendum.
And as well as kind of this call for constitutional change, what else was contained within that statement?
The statement has three parts. Voice was the first, and the other two parts was a call for treaty and a call for truth. So these are other forms of recognition, of course. So treaties, it's called the Makarrata, and I think that's probably a piece of the statement that has varying suggestions around how it'll be formed, perhaps how it will happen. States have already begun moving on the treaty process in the background. So thinking about with whom that treaty will be has been one of the key things. But truth, the truth-telling is something that I think will be interesting and will be quite historic. It comes partly out of the 1997 Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission inquiry into the removal of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their families. That Royal Commission involved an enormous amount of witnessing by Aboriginal people. It laid out very clearly the great pain that had been caused by Indigenous child removal, as well as some of the less painful consequences of that. And I think that sometimes that truth-telling is conceived of as something akin to the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, but also perhaps coming out of those that Royal Commission into the removal of children. So I think, again, that truth-telling will take a different kind of form. And, of course, so far we've only had one side of truth-telling. We haven't yet had police, missionaries, the white fella truth-telling is yet to come, I think, too.
And in terms of this idea of truth-telling and this context of pain and reconciliation, do you think the no outcome is likely to have an impact on these other two parts of the statement one way or the other?
It's really hard to know what the no vote means, actually. So on the one hand, the treaty process is already underway. I think Victoria and Queensland have both passed legislation already on the paths to treaty, and I think New South Wales and South Australia are both of their state governments are also exploring these options. So I'll be interested to see how the treaty part of it continues on, regardless of the referendum. The truth-telling, I think we need to prepare ourselves for a fair bit of truth-telling, actually. I read an interview with Noel Pearson just before the referendum. You know, he has spent his life trying to appeal to mainly conservative Australians. And as he put it, you know, the Aboriginal community have been asking nicely for a long time. And if we stop asking nicely, that might be the result. And I'm feeling a slight trepidation about what that might include or what that might involve, especially for Australia's international reputation. I think for its internal cohesion, I think there is more to come there. Yep.
There's a couple of things I'd like to pick up that you've mentioned. One is what is this idea of treaty? What might it look like? And you've talked about sort of these different states thinking of a path to a treaty. Is it something that will be done nationally, or is it something that is done on the state level? And also picking up this idea of Australia is a federal nation, but the states have a lot of power as well. And what does that mean in this whole process?
Yes. And I mean, these might be questions that Amy is a bit more placed to answer than me. I'm not a lawyer, I'm an historian. But I'm interested that the states have picked this up. So you're right, states have a huge amount of power in the Australian system. And really, you know, almost all of daily life is governed by state laws. There are state police, there's states control primary and secondary schooling. States determine just, you know, a huge amount of everyday life. So in some ways it makes a lot of sense for states to be the sites of treaty making. I wonder whether part of that treaty making will actually involve advisory groups to states government, to state governments, because that would be an obvious outcome. I'll be interested to see how those processes fit in alongside the native title tribunals that operate in states. So these are tribunals that negotiate land rights outcomes with clans. And they were brought into existence in the 90s after the native title judgment and then the subsequent Labor government laws that were introduced, the Native Title Act. Part of what the native title tribunals have been doing is taking cases that often don't meet the evidentiary threshold for a court case and negotiating outcomes for those. So again, that's another process that's been going on. But of course, an advisory group would work or a treaty group would work much more around social policy as well as land. And I think that's where probably treaties have some potential to make a difference. How do states police, how do states deal with child removal and welfare, or out of home care, as it's called? I think those things that are well within the state's remit will be the things that are really affecting Aboriginal daily life. And I'll be interested to see where that then leaves the federal government, really. I mean, the federal government legally, they hold responsibility for policies affecting Indigenous people. So I'll be really interested to see where that leaves the federal government, who in a way could find themselves kind of left behind in this process. I think what was happening with the referendum, it was two things. One, the functional part of it is to protect Aboriginal advisory groups from political whim. As we've seen with the Federated Councils, so FACATSI or ATSIC, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Council, they were both groups that were very long-lived, decades long each, and then disbanded under a change of government. So this is part of the problem, is that Indigenous people's voices might be part of the process. Whether they're listened to or not is a different question, but they're fragile, because those groups can be just disbanded by governments. So that's part of the constitutional recognition. Also, the other part of the constitutional recognition, of course, was hugely symbolic in enshrining recognition of Indigenous people into the Constitution. The Constitution currently says nothing of First Nations, says nothing of Indigenous people. And, you know, the irony is that it still has a clause allowing New Zealand to join the Federation, but it doesn't recognise its own First People. It's a real snag there, I think. That's why the constitutional recognition was really important.
Yeah, that symbolic recognition has a lot going for it, doesn't it?
Yeah, there are Aboriginal people who would say Yeah. But let's get on with the job. You know, symbolic recognition has come to take a huge place in particularly Australian public life. Anyone who's seen an Australian football code grand final will know that Welcome to Country is now a standard part. There's Indigenous rounds in football leagues, but they are very symbolic, and how much of a difference are they making to Indigenous lives is really a question that a lot of activists ask.
I know you've already mentioned that it's difficult to know what the outcome's going to mean, but just in this kind of preliminary few days, what do you think it might mean in terms of Australia moving forward, and particularly Australia-New Zealand relations moving forward?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that, of course, since the result came through. I think for Australia, one thing that I don't think we can dismiss lightly is that for the last 6 weeks or so, and before that for many people, Aboriginal politics has been the thing that they've all talked about. People are literally having conversations about whether Aboriginal people should have representation to Parliament. Now, voting yes or no on that, in some ways, I'm not sure the vote shows us the extent to which people have really thought about this and have been talking about it and perhaps have understood the issues better. Because some of those people who voted no because either it didn't go far enough or Aboriginal people wouldn't be listened to anyway. They haven't been in the past. Why would this change anything? So there were good reasons, for a better word, to vote no, as well as bad reasons to vote no. I mean, yeah, I really do wonder where this is going now. Where can we go with this? I think for Australia-New Zealand relations, as some of my friends and relations in Australia commented to me, they were a bit worried that the result of this referendum would confirm everything New Zealanders thought about Australians. And I think that it is very hard for this to not be damaging to Australia's international reputation. Regardless of the reasons people voted no, that it didn't pass in any state, there are real questions to be asked about that. The other thing that I think we've seen in the New Zealand general election, which we've had polls closed on the same day as the referendum, I think we've seen some of the nastiness in this general election campaign that we have not seen before in New Zealand. We've had candidates jostled. You know, we've had candidates whose homes have been broken into. We've had some very nasty social media, especially directed more particularly at Māori women. I think we've seen some very calculated political manoeuvring on the part of not on the part of candidates, but on supporters that have been designed to really panic the electorate about things like co-governance with Māori. And I think looking at the No campaign and the way it ran in Australia, with flat out disinformation in many cases, but with a really nasty undertone, I think in a way we need to be a bit prepared for that in New Zealand. I think that if questions of co-governance come onto the agenda, or whatever's happening with the ACT Party and the argument about wanting to have some kind of referendum about the treaty, however that would work, I'm not sure. But we can look to Australia to see where this kind of campaign goes. I think it could be, yeah, I think New Zealand's reputation as a nice, safe, gentle place might also be questioned a little bit, I think.
On that somewhat worrying note, we might end our kōrero, but thank you very much, Kate, for sharing your insights. And I know it's very early days, but it's also quite a good time to reflect what might happen and I guess what might be done about preventing some of these things from coming to pass if it's possible. Thank you very much anyway for sharing your ideas.
Thanks, Sally. The song's Paul Kelly's song, Special Treatment. which really speaks to me during this debate, where one of the arguments against voting yes was that Aboriginal people would get special treatment, and as the Paul Kelly song says, yep, they sure have.
Grandfather wore this land in chains, a land he called his own. He was given another name and taken into town. But he got special treatment, very special treatment. My father worked a 12-hour day as a stockman on the station. The very same work, but not the same pay as his white companions. He got special treatment, very special treatment. Mother and father loved each other well, but together they could not stay. They were split up against their will until their dying day. They got special treatment, very special treatment. Mama gave birth to a stranger's child, a child she called her own. Strangers came and took away that child to a stranger's home. She got special treatment, very special treatment. I never spoke my mother's tongue, I never knew my name. I never learned the song she sung. I was raised in shame. I got special treatment, very special treatment. Yeah, we got special treatment, very special treatment.
So we've had our first interview with Kate Hunter, and now we've got Amy Maguire from the University of Newcastle. Amy, if we could hear from you a little bit about your background, please, and what is it that makes you an ideal candidate for this discussion today?
Well, I don't know about ideal, Sally, but thank you very much for inviting me to participate. This is a stage point, I suppose, for me in something that I've been engaged in really since high school. I'm a human rights law academic at the University of Newcastle School of Law and Justice, and I'm a career academic working in human rights and teaching in human rights and Indigenous legal rights. And my PhD was on the right to self-determination. So as part of that lengthy study, I focused on self-determination for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia. I'm a non-Indigenous person who has a very deep personal engagement with social justice and reconciliation. I was in high school in the 1990s, which was a time of significant change for us here in Australia in terms of the Mabo decision and what flowed from that, and then subsequent campaigns for legal rights and reconciliation, which are ongoing. These days, I'm a board member of Reconciliation New South Wales and was a campaign volunteer for the Yes23 campaign. So I was very engaged in advocacy in my professional context, talking with students and community members through the university, and then on referendum day on a polling booth, handing out how to vote yes cards and trying to have conversations with people about how they might vote. So, like I said at the outset, I wouldn't call myself an ideal person, and this is not my fight in the sense that I'm not an Indigenous person myself, but I'm someone who is very invested in our country improving its capacity to not just recognise but properly address the rights claims of First Nations peoples and come to terms with our history.
Amy, given your involvement in the campaign and in the years leading up to it, you must be disappointed by the result.
To say the least, Sally, I'm personally very affected. I've found it very difficult to bounce back from the outcome, but more so I feel very concerned and deeply sad for my friends and colleagues and other First Nations people whose work I follow. There are so many people who've invested so much emotion and effort into this campaign. And for young people in particular, who are people I often get to encounter as a university teacher, I think that this comes as a major blow. And it's also really difficult to see what the next steps are.
You mentioned that for young people it was a blow. Are we seeing some difference in how people voted based on age?
There's actually a very significant difference in how people voted based on age. So the highest yes vote in terms of age brackets was in the younger range. I think 18 to 24-year-olds were the most likely to vote yes, and that was a sliding scale of support through to the oldest block of voters who were the least likely to vote yes. People around my age in their 40s were the deciders, I guess, in the sense that there was a large number of people in that age bracket who were undecided right up until close to the date of the referendum. And what we've seen in the outcome, which is around 40% for yes and 60% for no, is that people who were undecided, unconvinced or unsure went no.
Have there been other demographic trends that have been obvious through the data that's coming out now?
Yes, the other major trend is for inner city electorates, more affluent and more highly educated electorates to be more likely to vote in favour. There were only 32 electorates in Australia that had a yes majority. And for suburban, outer urban, regional and rural electorates, the no vote was much higher.
32 electorates voted yes. Do you know the statistics for the number that voted no?
Yes, we had 32 electorates bring out a majority yes vote, and that's out of the 151 electorates.
So definitely in the minority then. The other interesting statistic was that none of the states had a yes majority either.
That's correct. So for a referendum to succeed, we needed a majority of voters and a majority of states. We have six states and two territories. The territories are second tier in terms of how their votes count in relation to a referendum. So the ACT, the Australian Capital Territory, which is really just Canberra, was the only division out of our subnational jurisdictions to vote yes, and all of the states and the Northern Territory went no.
It's interesting what you say about the ACT voting yes, given the seat of government.
It's, I believe, the youngest capital in Australia, Canberra, and, of course, has a far higher proportion of highly educated professional workers, including the Commonwealth Public Service, which is based there.
Amy, in terms of the referendum itself, we saw a lot of controversy surrounding it. It would be really interesting to hear from you some of the core reasons why you think it was so controversial, given your background in human rights in Australia.
It's a really complicated picture, I think. I'm actually not quite sure what to start with. This was a really difficult and now quite punishing campaign. I would say one source of controversy that personally I found really difficult to tolerate during the campaign was almost confected, in the sense that we saw among First Nations people in Australia a sort of 80-20 divide. So around 80% were showing fairly consistently in the polls to be in support of a yes vote, and around 20% of First Nations peoples were showing to be against the Voice proposition. Within that 20%, there was a really broad spectrum of views, and on one end of that spectrum were key no campaigners like Senator Jacinta Namper-Jimper-Price and Warren Mundine, both of whom come from a conservative position politically, through to independent Senator Lydia Thorpe, who favoured what she termed a progressive no vote and was against the referendum for reasons including her view that it didn't go remotely far enough. So there was some common ground in that First Nations no grouping, but it was really diverse as well. And coming back to your question about controversy, one thing we saw was the fact that there wasn't unanimity, I suppose, among First Nations peoples was something that was made an issue by the No campaign, even though, of course, we could never expect any electoral cohort to have a unanimous perspective on a proposition. And by no means do we ever ask for 80% of support among the whole Australian population for any proposition. We don't need that to elect a government. In fact, governments are elected with less than a full majority at times. So that part for me was a source of controversy. And when I was meeting voters on referendum day, a few people did raise it with me. Well, I feel, as a non-Indigenous person, really confused about how I should vote, because I know that some Aboriginal people favour the proposition and some are against it. And I think that element of controversy was fed by perhaps a warped perspective in our mainstream media, particularly our national broadcaster, the ABC, which is bound to the idea of balance in reporting. A lot of the coverage I saw tended to give equal weighting to yes and no positions. And that was despite the fact that an awful lot of the no campaign materials, whether spread, you know, through official political sources or less transparent sources, were driven by misinformation or bald-faced lies, which meant to me that it was inappropriate for those two positions to be continually represented as though they were equal. And that's really well represented, I think, in the pamphlet that was sent by the Australian Electoral Commission to every household in Australia before the referendum, in which our parliamentarians had the opportunity to contribute to yes or no campaigns. And in that pamphlet, there was no requirement for fact-checking. So information was sent directly into households that was untrue and wrong. And we were bound then to have a controversial campaign. One other thing that I guess I'd mention briefly is that the role of social media and the proliferation of sources of information was a huge driver of controversy in this referendum. And I think that we can see very starkly how poorly off we are now as voters in terms of trying to reach shared understandings of what is true and what is correct, because it's very difficult for people to navigate the information landscape now. It's very difficult for people to be able to verify material and to feel confident in what they're receiving. So one thing I'm wondering as a lawyer coming out of this referendum is whether it's ever going to be possible for us to achieve constitutional change regardless of the proposition in the current landscape, because it's so difficult as a polity for us to reach a point where we agree that a particular position is true.
Kate spoke a little bit about disinformation as well and the danger not only in the referendums that's just been, but also moving forward from it now. And she touched on what it might mean for us here in New Zealand if ever a similar thing were to come to pass. So just as we finish up, Amy, any thoughts you have on how this might affect Indigenous rights, particularly in Australia, moving forward?
In terms of Indigenous rights in Australia following this referendum, it's very early to make any predictions. At the moment, we're still within what's been called for a week of silence and grieving by leaders of the Yes campaign. And of course, there's been an element of media discussion around the reasons why the Yes campaign wasn't successful. But that's very much beside the point, isn't it? And your question really goes to the heart of the matter. Where are we now in terms of Indigenous rights in Australia? Well, one thing we know is that the Prime Minister has confirmed that his government will not pursue a legislative voice to Parliament. So that part of the proposition for an indefinite period is dead. We do have multiple state and territory-based processes in train that are related to the voice or similar to the voice, and several states are also pursuing state-based treaty projects. And so I think that what we will see is a continued trend of subnational development in Indigenous legal rights and an unfortunate furthering of that as an indication that the national government has for several decades now found it very difficult to achieve progressive change in this area. In terms of campaigning among First Nations people, I think that this will be a really interesting and difficult time. There will undoubtedly be many voices raised in favour of truth-telling, which was also at the heart of the Uluru Statement from the Heart reform agenda. One thing that I heard in the immediate aftermath of the referendum result from some First Nations commentators was that this outcome really demonstrates how poorly Australians as a whole understand the lived experiences of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and what their rights ought to look like and what their aspirations are for recognition of those rights. So I think that truth-telling will be an area of demand. And we'll also continue to see a lot of focus on sovereignty and treaty campaigns, but also probably a swing among some Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people towards more radical politics and less confidence in the capacity of broad uniting reform campaigns or government to deliver what their aspirations are.
Again, I think Kate was raising quite similar thoughts. I would like to say thank you so much for sharing your expertise.
Thank you. It was certainly my pleasure. I was very fortunate recently to visit Ngāti Rua New Zealand, and it was so enlightening for me to learn more about similarities and differences in our national approaches to the rights of Indigenous peoples. So I really appreciate the chance to be part of this discussion on your great podcast, Sally. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Good evening. Here is the news.
Chance to
So we're now on to our third interview. We've spoken with Kate Hunter about some of the context already around the referendum and what that might mean in terms of the result. And we've spoken with Amy Maguire about what's been going on, particularly within Australia and Indigenous rights within Australia. Now we've got Claire Chatters, who's going to round out our panel of three interviewees. And we're going to focus specifically on what the referendum might mean in terms of Indigenous rights here in Aotearoa and also internationally, with Claire's expertise in those fields. Claire, it would be lovely to hear a wee bit more about your background and what it is that you bring to today's kōrero.
Hopefully I bring something to the kōrero. So my background is that I'm a professor of law at the University of Auckland. When I teach predominantly comparative law and Indigenous people's rights around especially the Anglo and English-speaking world. And I worked for a while at the United Nations as well. And finally, I'm currently the Rongomai Takitaki at the New Zealand Human Rights Commission. So I'm a governance partner with the commissioners on Indigenous people's rights.
Did you follow the referendum closely, what was happening in Australia?
I'm not there. I'm not in the context, I suppose, not living there, but I was reading newspapers and following it probably more closely than most. I've known for a long time through my UN work Megan Davis, who I guess has been a key leader, if not the face of the voice. I've talked to her about it from time to time as well.
And have you spoken to her since the results come through?
No, I haven't. We texted just before the vote, but I haven't, partly because I didn't, really want to bother her. I'm sure she is exhausted and, I'm sure she probably is still decompressing a little bit, right?
Yeah. Claire, to start us off, could you maybe kind of introduce some of the ways in which Indigenous rights, and particularly the situation of Māori rights here in New Zealand, were being used in the referendum campaign in Australia. And interestingly, mm-hmm. it was being used by both sides in quite different ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So as I understand it, one of the arguments made in the No campaign was that the Waitangi Tribunal, potentially also the seats in Parliament, gave Māori far too many rights. What bothered me about that is that the Waitangi Tribunal is very different than a voice to Parliament, and it only has recommendatory powers and is often followed by the government anyway of the day. So that wasn't a good analogy. In terms of the positive side, then I think there was some reference to seats in Parliament here. Generally, there's a sense that Indigenous people's rights, if not formally recognised, are constitutionally significant here in Aotearoa because of Te Tiriti o Waitangi. I did hear also that the sort of anti-co-governance group was getting a little bit of airtime. I'm not sure to what extent, but the arguments that co-governance is divisive, for example, I understand that that was part of some media or political dialogue, but as academics, we like to be 100% correct, and I'm just sort of talking about news reports I've heard from here. So to the extent that it's true, I guess that's was part of the dialogue.
And if we move now to think about the result, I guess it wasn't so much unexpected in that's what the polls had been suggesting. But it would be good to hear your thoughts on how you feel and what you think it might mean moving forward.
To be honest, I think the 60% no was a lot higher than anticipated.
Mm.
I think it's kind of heartbreaking. I mean, when you understand the context of the lack or exclusion of Aboriginal peoples in Australia in so many different ways, economically, socially, but also legally, it's heartbreaking that there was this opportunity and it hasn't happened. Putting Indigenous people's rights when you've got such a small minority of Aboriginal peoples is always dangerous. And it's exactly why you need rights, right, to avoid the tyranny of the majority and subjecting them. So that's one thing that bothers me a lot about this. I've pondered the idea that maybe it will be such an incredible embarrassment that the voice referendum didn't go positively and will lead to sort of condemnation globally, I think. on Australia, that it might actually galvanize change actually in the sort of medium term. I can't help but thinking that the no vote is fundamentally reflects the extent of racism that still exists. I can't understand how such a marginalized people's, historically extreme and egregious human rights abuse against them can't even get some sort of recommendatory voice to Parliament. I mean, that is to me incomprehensible. So those are some reflections, let's say.
So I know it's very early days, but what else might you think we could see coming from this? How about in terms of Indigenous rights globally?
Look, I think in many places where there's, a swing to the right, Indigenous rights might be under threat. While there could well be condemnation of Australia, there's also the potential that it gives other states permission also not to recognise Indigenous people's rights. I understand, I just read a news report that, for example, that David Seymour has said that it's a good thing that the referendum didn't pass, and maybe could use that, I don't know, to politically argue for this proposed referendum on Te Tiriti o Waitangi. Yeah. I think it can potentially cut both ways. It's potentially dangerous as well.
So in terms of a global network, I suppose, of Indigenous rights groups and activists, I guess what I'm wondering about is delegations to the UN.
Australia is very active on these issues. In fact, Australia often comes across more strongly than New Zealand. There's always that paradox. The states who have very poor records on Indigenous people's rights can be quite vocally positive about Indigenous people's rights at United Nations level.
Interesting, isn't it?
It is. It's something that is a bit heartbreaking, to be honest. And when you see it in action, the hypocrisy, it's, it is problematic.
Definitely. Have you got anything else that you'd like to say in terms of your feelings or where you think this might lead or potential implications?
I wonder how it will impact on the treaty negotiations that are happening at a state level. I don't know how that will impact. I wonder whether in some states there will be an impetus for stronger rights during the treaties, because you have to account for the fact that there is no voice to Parliament. I don't know that for sure. That's one question that is in my mind. I've already said that maybe the embarrassment of the no vote hopefully might propel some greater change in the long term. But equally, the converse might be true. So, I think we've covered off, most of the potential pros and cons there and what could happen in the future. There has been other ideas for constitutional change. So whether it's a non-discrimination clause in the constitution as well. So maybe other avenues will be sought, but they didn't have as much support as a voice.
It certainly will be interesting to see what happens. I wonder if the states end up taking more of a lead in it.
I think that's got to be the case. I think that has to be the case, right? Yes, one more thing that I would add is that argument of Indigenous rights being divisive is highly problematic, because if you're an Indigenous person, Indigenous Aboriginal person, and your rights have been so egregiously breached and you can't even get recognition of a recommendatory voice to Parliament, that is just, it aggravates exclusion. So this argument that voice to Parliament was about division is, I think, plainly wrong. But the only way, I think, to include Aboriginal peoples in Australian society is to at least recognise some of their rights and influence in the executive. That's similarities with arguments here in Aotearoa too.
Yeah, and there was the argument that it's a little bit similar to a Māori ward or Māori seats to Parliament, but
yeah,
although there are similarities, it's not exactly the same.
No. with representation on local councils, that's part of guaranteeing you're part of a decision-making body, right? You sit alongside, whereas the voice is about having some entity that's reflective of Indigenous voices that just advises the lawmaking power. So that's kind of quite different. So it's the difference between having, say, seats in Parliament, where you are going to be a minority, pretty much even with suggestions of guaranteed seats at local council, or different models that were put forward in different places, whereas you'll be a cohesive voice, although there'd undoubtedly be differences in what people thought and the, you know, and within that, but yeah, you're advising.
I'd like to say thank you. I know you're a super busy person, so thank you for finding a few minutes to chat with us.
Oh, absolute pleasure.